We shift gears just a little bit with the help of Jethro Tull from 1978, Locomotive Breath. I said at the beginning of the program that Preston Dennett had written 14 UFO books. I was wrong. It's 15 UFO books, books about UFOs and the paranormal. And he's been my guest on this program. I even interviewed him for television and a book he wrote about UFOs over Nevada. He started down this road because of experiences that were reported to him by his family and friends and coworkers about things they had seen, weird encounters with alien or unknown craft. And the newest work is different from the other reports that he's done, the other books that he's written, because the experiences recounted in this particular book we're going to talk about tonight are sort of up close and personal, in your face, where people have these kinds of encounters with beings face to face over a period of years. And there's a considerable amount of evidence to back up their stories. In a moment, Preston Dennett shares those stories with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Preston Dennett began investigating UFOs and the paranormal back in 1986 after he had been hearing stories from various people in his life, family, friends, coworkers, about dramatic unexplained encounters. This new book, his 15th, is called Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. Preston, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks, George. Thanks for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Sure. So tell me a little bit about the stories you started hearing that got you down this road. What kind of stories?
I didn't believe in UFOs, actually. The first story that really broke the ice for me was that on the news, the sighting by Kenju Tiroshi of a sighting over Alaska back in 1986. A real famous sighting, actually.
The JAL, Japan Airlines case?
Exactly. Yeah, it was kind of tongue-in-cheek on the news, but it interested me enough to ask people in my family, friends and coworkers. And my brother, that was one of the first stories I heard. He and his two friends chased this object. They described it as metallic with colored lights on it, a dome on top, across the San Fernando Valley here in Southern California. They passed other cars who were also chasing it. I ended up interviewing both his friends. And so that was kind of interesting, I thought. My sister-in-law, married to my other brother, she described seeing these lights over Van Nuys Air Force Reserve Base here in the valley. Also had two friends with her. I ended up interviewing one of them. And she later described to me this encounter she had with gray-type ETs, I guess you would call it, the typical case. She saw them in front of Stagg Street Elementary School, of all places. Didn't really know what she was describing, but I was, you know, matching exactly what I was reading in the books I was beginning to pick up on the subject. So, yeah, this subject hit home for me. It was not good news. I felt scandalized. People I knew and loved for years were kind of keeping secrets from me.
You hadn't had an experience yourself. Is that still true?
No, actually, now I've had a number of sightings, some pretty close up and I would say profound and, you know, definitely unexplained.
And is it like they're seeking you out, or is it the fact that your senses are heightened and you're looking for it?
No, well, at least some they're seeking me out, some I'm seeking them out. But there was one, I'm driving along, no kidding, on my way home from my brother's house. This is in Woodland Hills, late 1980s, right after I started getting into this. And this ball of light drops down out of the sky. I'll never forget it. I thought it was a bird at first, but it came right in front of my windshield instantly. I mean, it targeted me, clearly. And I'm thinking, okay, it's a golf ball, but no, golf balls don't just float there. And this thing moves back and forth in front of my windshield, I'm going to say two or three times, long enough for me to clearly see it. And it dips down a little bit and then goes straight up through the trees and, you know, straight up into outer space, I guess. And that happened a second time later on the freeway on the way to a UFO meeting. So things like that, I've had a couple things like that, a couple of really good sightings, actually, when I was with someone who was having regular encounters. She basically took me out to see UFOs and they showed up.
Is that one of the stories in the book?
Or
one of the people that's in this new book?
No, I haven't told that one.
All right. Well, tell me this. In the other books that you wrote, UFOs Over Nevada, which is the one that I interviewed you for a television a news program, UFOs Over New York, New Mexico, you wrote Supernatural California. And there's a sort of a pattern. I mean, you cast a wide net over, you know, a particular region, and you collect the stories from various media and put them together.
Right.
This book seems different, though. It seems like maybe you've been stashing these stories on the side. Did you have an idea that you were going to write this one, and you'd been saving these along the way?
Well, yeah, you pretty much hit the nail on the head there. Huh. It is different, you know, and I'm super excited about it because of that. You know, those other books are fun to write, don't get me wrong, but it entails a lot of research from a wide variety of sources, whereas this one is really personal to me. These are people I've interviewed myself. This is nothing that's ever been published before, so it's in some ways easier to write, in some ways harder, you know, to put together.
Well, we're going to get into the stories in a minute. Before we do, one other general question. It's about the idea of a UFO hotspot. You know, we hear that a lot, that there are right. certain areas of the country or around the world where it's a UFO hotspot. Yeah, when you read your books, it seems like if you do careful research, everywhere is a UFO hotspot.
Yeah, to a certain extent. I mean, there's an argument that UFO hotspots are just a publicized incident that sort of sparks other reports. I'm not sure that's entirely true. But I think there are hotspots, you know, like Hudson Valley in upstate New York, certainly is a well-known spot, and Sedona, Arizona, that area, the Topanga Canyon, Santa Monica Mountains. I think that is a true phenomena. But yeah, this stuff is everywhere, and doesn't matter if you're, you know, I've got a case in the Marriott Hotel in Woodland Hills, which has got to be the most densely populated area in the San Fernando Valley, which already has a million people in it. So these guys can get you anywhere if they want.
So the stories we're about to hear, you've been sort of working on them over a long period of time, because some of them are very intricate and detailed, and they stretch out over years. So you've been sort of adding to them as you go along, right? So these are from people who they just pop up in your life and share their stories with you, or you seek them out, or it's a combination?
Combination. I mean, there's one case with a lady I worked with for years, and you know, I don't really bring up that I'm a UFO guy at work. Sometimes I do. I mean, it comes up. She actually walked into my office, and I just put up a statue of a little gray alien. And she looks at it and kind of lets out this shriek and, you know, points to it and says, "What's that?" I'm like, "Well, you know, what do you think it is?" She says, "I don't know, but I saw this thing right after I had my baby." And so that's how I got that story. Some of the people are directly from work. One guy, the first chapter, probably one of my favorite accounts in the book, he actually heard me lecture, saw me, you know, putting up slides of praying mantis type ETs, and came up to me afterwards to share his experience. I've since interviewed him many times. It's an incredible story. He's a Navy medic.
Well, let's jump into it. How this story came to you? Because we're talking here not about people who just see a weird craft in the sky or some kind of an odd light. This is face to face on board accounts, and this one is. It's pretty amazing. So he says in the beginning, "I've been in contact with aliens since I was 10 years old." That would put my warning antenna would go up if somebody told me that.
Right, right. This is actually what his friend said. I mean,
okay.
I call him Larry as a pseudonym. I do have his real name. But Kevin Kamen is the name of the witness. He's a Navy medic on this. And his friend was a personnel clerk, claimed to be a contactee, in contact with the aliens, who not only took them regularly, but took them to their planet and other planets. So yeah, this was too much for Kevin to swallow. He believed in UFOs, but not to the extent where his best friend was, you know, in contact with them. But a couple of days later, you know, Larry comes back and says, "Guess what, Kevin? I just went to your house. My friends took me to your house." And Kevin lived in Kankakee, Illinois. And Larry starts to describe all the details of his house in perfect detail, which was upsetting enough, but what he was describing was about 10 years in the past. I mean, there was a car in the yard he was describing, and they didn't even have it anymore.
He had details down to, like, there's a coffee stain or something on the back seat, or?
Right, right. art. I mean, just incredible detail. So it was clear he was there. It was clear he was there at a different time, or, you know, looking into the past somehow. So that really upset Kevin more than the actual accuracy of the information, that it was all from the past.
So they're on a ship, right? There's no, they're somewhere thousands of miles away. There's no way that this guy slipped away during the interim period and saw this stuff.
Right. I mean, they're on the Philippines. There's just no way. It's thousands of miles away, exactly. But so it interests Kevin enough. I mean, he's known this guy for a good time at this point. And tells him, well, okay, if this is true, I want to meet your little green friends. And this is when Larry says, okay, I'll see what I can do. Comes back a couple of days later and says, yep, I set it up. They'll be here tomorrow. So this is when, this is what started it all. Kevin, you know, asked for an experience, and apparently he got it, because the next day came, and Larry appears in the cabin and says, okay, they're here. Go up on deck. You'll see them. And Kevin's still skeptical, but he goes up on deck, and he sees this massive craft. He said it was kind of star-shaped or diamond-shaped. It was much larger than the ship he was on, which was 500, 600 feet. It was right alongside the ship there and just in full display. He runs to get another witness. There are several other people on the deck. And he's shaking this guy's shoulders, the mess cook there, and can't get his attention. Next thing he knows, Kevin knows, he's not on the Navy ship anymore. He's up looking down on the Navy ship from apparently the UFO. And this completely freaked him out. He can see himself still standing on the deck of the Navy ship there. And suddenly it's just receding to this tiny little dot as if they're going into outer space. And he's thinking, oh, I'm AWOL. And a voice comes on and said, nope, they don't even know you're gone. So he's realizing now, okay, I'm on this ship. And he's fully conscious. He can see the ground he's standing on. It's kind of this metal great work. He's just looking out standing kind of on the outer edge of this, inside of this object, looking outward. And the wall becomes transparent. And it's very bizarre what he sees. He's back over his hometown. And he sees his mom teaching in the churchyard there where she teaches. Suddenly this object moves a couple of miles away and moves to the bank building where his dad is working. And these ETs start talking to him. Presumably ETs. He doesn't know at this point what exactly is happening. And they say...
He doesn't see them at this point, right? He's just hearing a voice or something? They're talking to him in his head?
Right. Exactly. He's too afraid to turn around is what it is. So he's kind of just trembling there. I mean, he pinched his hand so hard it came until it bled. Because it was very frightening for him. He did not expect this to be a real experience, and suddenly he was there. So the ETs start talking to him, and they said, your parents are very honorable people. You know, they did a good job, this type of thing, which, you know, doesn't make a whole lot of sense to him. He doesn't know exactly why they're telling him this. Suddenly, this ship is in another place, and now he knows for sure they're time traveling because he sees himself. He's like 8 years old. There's his aunt. She's deceased. So he's very confused at this point and says, you know, Preston, you know, I probably forgot some of this stuff. A lot was happening. But the next thing he remembers, this might not be the right order, he says, but they're looking down. He's looking down to the bottom of the ship at this point, can still see through it, and he sees a desert landscape. And then it kind of, there's craters there, and he's thinking, okay, this is weird because it looks like the moon. And suddenly they come up over the crest of this hill there, and there's the Earth in the background. He says it's the size of a softball, and that's when he kind of lost it. He just could not believe this was happening. And he started saying, oh, my God, you know, who are you guys, and where you come from, and what's going on? And he says, and this is a very interesting detail. He says the room suddenly expanded in size. This is something I've heard from other people who've, you know, had this type of experience.
Yeah.
These UFO rooms will actually change in size. And that's what happened to him. And he said it turned into this star chart. You could see Earth, Mars, you know, our planets, a bunch of stars. And way off in the distance on the far side of the room, this little red light was blinking. And they're like, well, that's us. It's like, oh, okay. And this, he finally got his courage to start asking questions, and they answered pretty much as fast as he could think them, and told them a bunch of stuff. They said they're in contact with all the major governments on Earth. They told them they speak all the languages of our planet and have been watching us for a very long time. They said that when we started exploding nuclear bombs, this caused special attention to be paid to us from them and a bunch of other races who are also watching us. And they said when we did that, it started a countdown clock. This is what they told them. Didn't really elaborate other than to say your destiny will be fulfilled, and proceeded to show him, and this is also very common, something I've heard in a number of cases.
Yeah, it's like alien editorials.
They proceeded to show him these future disasters, basically showing him hurricanes, tornadoes, landslides, earthquakes, more hurricanes, a lot of hurricanes, he said, mine disasters. They showed him himself actually having a personal motorcycle accident, which, you know, 20 years later did actually happen. So they were showing him all this stuff as if he was actually there and saying, your destiny will be fulfilled. So, yeah, they told him all kinds of stuff. At one point he asked about God, and he said they wouldn't answer that and actually told him that they do not discuss race, religion, or politics.
That's wise of them. He asked them the name of the planet, right, where they're from?
Right, he did, and they told him. And he says, you know, don't quote me because I can't pronounce it. You know, I made him do it anyway, and he just kind of mumbled through it. He just could not understand it. It sounded like gibberish to him. But they told him whatever he wanted to know. Finally, you know, he's getting up the courage to see what these guys look like. You know, mind you, he's still looking out the side of the craft here. And he turns around, and he sees that they're sitting on these sort of marble white chairs with large backrests, large round backrests, like almost like thrones, he said. And it's up on a dais, and it is three very large praying mantis type ETs. And I'm like, well, how large? He says, well, one stood up and it was taller than a basketball board, you know, on a basketball court. And I mean, he's a Navy medic, trained observer. I'm like, no, you know, that's too tall. And I've heard of 9 feet tall. And I tried to talk him down. He's like, no, you know, this is how tall it was. Twice his height easily. This freaks him out. Obviously, he said they were very white. Their skin was absolutely white. And very thin limbs. Kind of a round, claw-like hands. A sort of very praying mantis type face, and but very, very large head. They oozed intelligence. They just radiated it. And he says he was most impressed by their eyes. They were very large, kind of triangular shaped, but about the size of basketballs. And just stared down at him in a way that made him feel like a little bug, ironically.
Let me ask you this, Preston, before we continue with the story. Why do you believe this account? I mean, it's an incredible story. What makes it believable for you?
Well, I mean, I interviewed him face-to-face, and what made it believable to me is not only his sincerity and the emotion that he expressed as he told his story, and the fact that he has character witnesses like his wife and his brother, who incidentally also had an abduction experience. I go through that whole process, and when I see these little red flags, like he's describing how the room changed size, well, not a lot of people know about that sort of detail. Something I've only heard, you know, a few times. And he was really impressed by it and trying to describe, you know, it. And that's sort of a red flag to me.
Were you able to interview the other Navy guy who had introduced him to the praying mantises?
No, I wasn't. And I did search for him. I mean, his name was kind of unusual. I don't like cold calling people. I've had some very bad experiences in that regard, you know, calling up people I found out about their encounters and they don't know it. And so that's a difficult job to do. And but, you know, his case was so incredible, I did look for him.
Well, that's a maybe we could help you find him. I don't know. We'll have to talk about that off the air, but that would be a pretty good detail since he seemed to be the one who had the relationship with these beings wherever the heck they were from. We're going to continue this story because there's a lot more to come and other stories in the book called Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. Jackson Brown takes us into the break. Rolling Stone magazine had an article out in the last week. It's titled something like How Elvis Costello Helped Paul McCartney Get His Mojo Back. And it's a reference to the making of this album. It's called Flowers in the Dirt. The song is 20 Fine Fingers. Paul McCartney and Elvis Costello banging it out there. It actually, this cut didn't make the first album, but it's now on part of a grand reissue that came out this week. I got it. It's really good stuff. We're talking with Preston Dennett about his new book, Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact, some amazing stories that he's collected over the years. We'll get right back to it right after this on Coast to Coast AM. Preston Dennett, let's go back to the story you've been telling here. So the guys on this ship, these giant three praying mantises who are talking to him, they ask him a question, and he sort of bails out on it. They ask him, you want to go see our planet?
Right, yep. And he says, no, I don't want to. He felt, you know, this experience was too overwhelming at this point. He just wanted to get out of there. He felt like a trapped animal. And they reach out. You know, they're fussing with the dials there on their console, which is about chest high. It's got little oven dials, it looks like, colored lights, pretty plain. Turn right to him and, you know, ask him, do you want to go to our planet? And he says, no. They reach out and grab his shoulder, and that's more than he can really handle. He starts screaming. He passes out. Next thing he knows, he's no longer with these guys, with these ETs. He is back on the Navy ship. He's not on the deck anymore. He's back in his bunk. Actually, he's laying down. He's fully conscious. He's awake. He's drenched in sweat, screaming, calms down, and the curtain whips open, and there's his friend, Larry, and says, how'd you like your little ride? Well, Kevin didn't like it. It really upset him. He lost that friend. He didn't want to talk to Larry anymore. And basically drove the experience out of his mind. He didn't remember it, a lot of it, for a couple of years after this. Almost immediately, sort of amnesia settled over him, and he remembered going on board. He didn't remember what these guys looked like, didn't remember what they told him, just kind of some scattered imagery. And a couple of years later, he's back at home. He's with his wife. He's watching a nature show. And on the TV comes this praying mantis. Does a close-up on him, and that's what I call a cue. I've got this in a couple of other cases. This wall of amnesia just kind of breaks down, and he remembers this entire experience. So, yeah, it's an unusual experience for sure. It's what I would call an outlier. But there are these weird details that do match up or corroborate with other cases. I did a preliminary interview with him and several main interviews and a follow-up interview. I'm still in contact with him. He's a very interesting guy and kind of gung-ho about getting the word out about this because it transformed his life.
You said he had pinched himself until he bled while he's on this craft. And then, you know, he wakes up, he's in his bunk, but it's not a dream, you think, because he actually has that wound, that injury.
Right, yeah. This is what he said. He showed me a tiny little scar, very faint, where he said this happened. And, you know, he did not have a whole lot of evidence. A lot of these people don't have evidence. There's a glaring lack of physical evidence in this field. There's no denying it. I mean, there's certainly, you know, landing trace cases. There's a number of cases involving medical evidence. There's several like that in this book.
You said there's in the story you tell in the book, though, there is one thing that happens. He's shown all these things that are going to happen in the future, and then one particular event that happened directly to him involving the motorcycle.
Right. You know, he actually watched some of these disasters on TV, and he was like, you know, that looks awfully familiar. But the thing that really clinched it for him was right after he bought this new motorcycle. He owned it maybe a week or two and had a very bad accident on it. And recalled this is exactly what the ETs had warned him about. And it was, you know, a bike model that hadn't even been invented yet at the time he had the onboard experience.
So, unlike some of the other stories you tell in the book, I mean, that was pretty much it for him. He didn't have another UFO experience. It ended for him, though he still is interested.
This is often a generational thing. You know, people have this in their childhood and repeated experience. Nope, not him. It was just an out-of-the-blue experience, which did follow a pattern I've seen, which is if you know somebody who's having regular contact, this increases your chances of having contact.
The praying mantis thing is not common, but it does pop up now and then. There are other reports of those kind of beings.
Yeah, I'm going to say it's probably my second most common, maybe third. There's the grays. Those dominate for sure, over 50%, 60%, you know, maybe up to 70%. Variations of it, though, you know, short grays and tall grays and various emotions described in uniforms and even colors. But that's second most common. It's definitely praying mantis, usually described as, I'm going to say, 8 to 9 feet. I've got another case like that in the book involving a 9-foot-tall praying mantis. Kevin's case with 15 feet is definitely an outlier.
So this was like a dwarf praying mantis then. you said it was an outlier in a sense. The second story that you tell in the book is there's some common threads. This is to an 11-year-old boy. Taylor Foster is the pseudonym. So tell us, you can tell it happened a long time ago just by the details of how he has his first encounter. His mom allows him to go out at night to go 3 blocks down the street. No sane parent would do that anymore. I guess it depends on where you live.
Yeah, this is in St. Louis, Missouri, on a, you know, fairly crowded street. And just, you know, 9 o'clock, going to mail out a letter, nothing really unusual. But he's heading home and suddenly sees this object right over him. And, you know, he's not thinking UFOs, doesn't really know what those are, but can see it's a ship, obviously, and not a plane. And it flashes down this beam of light. And he said, started to describe, you know, this feeling to me, which I've heard other witnesses try to say, which is sort of this clearing of consciousness, sort of a raising of awareness. One guy told me it was like being more aware than he's ever been. And this is how Taylor suddenly felt. He's running home and just feels transformed, mentally enlightened, like he can think faster and knows more, and doesn't know what to make of it, but finds when he gets home, it's well over an hour later than it should be. His mom's furious, and he doesn't want to explain to her. He's more interested in telling her, you know, how good he feels, and she doesn't want to hear that. But over the next couple of days, he starts to remember what happened. He says this beam of light came down, and next thing he knows, he's on board this thing, what he believes is a mothership, and it was piloted, or he talked to these, what you would call Nordic ETs, ETs that look just like us, human, but perhaps, you know, better looking, in that they're, you know, very well put together, great haircuts, very muscular, very fit looking, usually around 6 feet tall. This is what he described. He said that they were very similar looking, another detail we also hear a lot, and just very, very kind. And he felt like they were almost enlightened or angelic type beings, just really fully realized, aware.
Did he tell his mom that this story eventually, I mean, he had to, at in that same time period, did he cough this up to his mom and tell her what had happened?
No, not at this time, no. No, he kept his secret. This was his secret. These guys were wearing uniforms, you know, black with white stripe, I believe it was, or vice versa. And this sort of came out over a period of days and totally transformed his life. I mean, he started seeing UFOs regularly at this point. They moved out of the city back into a farm area outside of St. Louis. And he continued to have encounters. And he had another one involving this sort of weird, well, not time travel, but what I would call a time-stopping incident. Very bizarre, but one I've heard a couple of times. He and his whole family were rushed outside. They were looking at this UFO. It was a classic flying saucer, metallic, little lights around it. But this time, you know, they'd seen this before. But this time, it's really close. And they're all looking at it. And Taylor, he rushes inside. He's going to grab his shotgun because it has a scope on it. He can look at this object much closer. He's not planning on shooting at it. Just wants to, you know, get a good view. And runs outside with the gun and the rifle scope, sees the UFO, puts the scope up, and can't find it. puts it down, and the UFO is gone, but he turns around, and his family around him is completely frozen in place. His father is holding a bucket. You know, the liquid is sloshing out over the edge. It's frozen. You know, birds frozen in the sky, which doesn't make sense to, you know, Larry, or I mean, I'm sorry, Taylor, or me for that matter, because he can move. And how do you explain that? So he's running around, turns to his right, and sees in front of the house, the UFO has now landed. Three grays are getting out, and they're walking towards him. And this is all he remembers. But this basically started a lifetime of contact, some which involved missing time, certainly, but several which involved fully conscious contact, where he actually conversed with these guys and learned quite a bit about them.
I want to, before we leave this incident, it said he grabbed a gun, not a shotgun, if it's got a scope on it. So he grabbed a rifle.
A rifle, right.
And so he's pointing it at him, and I guess he had a thought, well, he couldn't see the UFO anymore, and maybe they took off because they thought he was going to shoot at him.
Yeah, that was a concern, but I'm not sure that that's necessarily the case.
Right, since it landed.
Right.
So this kid has a lifetime of experiences, and eventually, I guess, there's somewhere in this chapter where you tell the story that his mom recalls that he had spoken a weird language from an early age.
Right, right.
What do you make of that?
Something that turns up in a couple of other cases. Not sure what to make of it, to be perfectly honest. But it's one of those weird little aspects which makes me think perhaps these guys are influencing us in ways that we don't quite understand, or our relationship with them is perhaps a lot closer than we realize.
You tell the story that he had something that fell out of his nose. Tell that one.
Yes, this happens in at least 3 or 4 of the cases report this kind of thing. And he reported that as well. He believes it was an implant. Later on, and he was, as an adult, that happened when he was a child. Later on as an adult, he had this cyst appear on his face, and he and his wife were concerned about it, just mildly concerned. It didn't appear to be, you know, hurting him in any way. But he kind of jokes, oh, you know, maybe it's an implant. Well, that night, the ETs actually take him on board the craft, and they're furious, and they're kind of, you know, chastising him, saying, this is ridiculous. You've gone through far too many of these implants, and this can't keep going on. Basically telling him this. And he's like, oh, you know, that was an implant. I was just joking. So he's conversing with these guys almost, you know, like you and I would. And they're like, yes, that was an implant, and now we've got to remove it. He's like, no, you don't have to remove it. You know, I won't take it out. And they're like, no, we're removing it, and we're going to put it back in you and you're in a place you'll never find it. So he got to the point where he overcame his fear and was able to converse with these guys on a number of subjects. He once asked, or became curious, rather, about how they transport people when their crafts are darting around all over the place. And they basically took him into a chair and said, this is how we do it. Placed him inside this chair that filled up with liquid. The top part came down from the ceiling, and he was made to breathe the liquid. He didn't want to do it, but they told him, it's all right. You can breathe this liquid. Another very rare procedure you don't hear a lot about. He's not well read on UFOs. He hasn't read anything on this subject. Just stayed away from it. But didn't know, you know, I mean, Betty Andreasen described this exact type of thing. So, yeah, he's got all kinds of insights like this into, you know, what the ETs are doing and how they do it.
You have a section where you describe an incident that you actually could verify with another witness, that involving his wife, where they're in a car driving. I think it's, or his mom, or his wife.
Right, right. Well, actually, you know, a number of these cases do involve multiple witnesses. That was a particularly interesting incident where this gentleman, a car mechanic, was driving down the highway. This is actually, I think, the cover of the book illustrates this particular incident. This is in Vandalia, Ohio. Driving down the highway at night, his wife is in the passenger seat, and up ahead they see this kind of sphere floating next to the road. And as they get closer, they see, well, it's obviously not a plane or a helicopter, and it's right there. I mean, it's, you know, maybe 50 feet up, right off to the side of the road there. And it's got a huge picture window. And as they drive up to it, they look inside, and it's two gray-type ETs. They are right there. They're staring face-to-face, kind of locking gazes. He says he could actually, that's what he felt. He felt like they were trying to lock his gaze, and he could read their mind, and he could read theirs to a certain extent. And what he got was that they were very, very intelligent and just kind of looked right through you. But he could see their little hands, you know, their eyes, their little suits, and there was a little lever in the center there. He's like, look, honey, you know, UFOs. She did not want to look. She actually refused to be interviewed and would not look at this object and forced him to keep driving. So he eventually capitulates, drives on, and this object follows them all the way home. And he's like, honey, it's following us. He speeds up. It speeds up. He slows down. It slows down. He speeds up, screeches into the driveway. She runs into the house. He runs into the house, calls everyone out, and this object scoots up into the sky, stays there for a little bit, and then, boom, takes off. So they all saw it, but only he and his wife saw this thing up close.
There, he has a bunch of other instances where there are multiple witnesses. There's something that happens at the neighbors where this thing is following him, and he just almost is, I don't know if it's like a lark, decides to see if it follows him to the neighbor's place.
Right. This is something, you know, he had this problem where he'd wake up in the morning and they'd be there, hovering pretty low in the sky, and follow him to work. They'd follow him home. They were following him quite all over the place. They were coming down very close on occasions. He would go out into his backyard. He's like, gosh, is that one?
So does he photograph him? Does he get video?
No, he hasn't. He has not gotten video. At least not at this point that I know of.
I mean, is that a red flag for you? Or I would think if you're all over the place, you'd want to go ahead and document it, or is he not supposed to?
Yeah, you know, this is a problem that I've definitely run into with other cases. I'm like, why didn't you photograph it? And for a lot of people, you know, they don't have great reasons. Some, you know, don't have their camera handy. This is something I hear, or it happens very quickly.
Yeah, but for this guy, it happened a bunch. It's all over the place.
Yeah, he had some very close encounters. And he was with a number of people who were also there, and they did not film it either. I do have cases, you know, where people have sent me some really impressive footage. I'm working with one right now. It's very interesting. So it does happen. And there's certainly some very good footage I've seen.
It kind of comes with the territory. People either don't think about it, or they're mesmerized by the object. They don't want to take their gaze off of it, or they don't have a camera, or if they do have a camera, it doesn't work. Or if they do have a camera, it just doesn't occur to them. I know it's weird, but it would drive me crazy.
Yeah, well, you know, there are, like I said, some good photographic incidents. There was a great case on Catalina Island that I was interviewing this kid about, and they had cell phones, and they all went out. Boom, boom, boom. And another case on same area, actually, involving 11 people, they had multiple cameras, and not one of them worked. That's something that turned up a lot in the Hudson Valley wave.
Yeah, it's true. It's frustrating, but it happens. We're talking with Preston Dennett about his newest book, Inside UFOs, True Accounts of Contact. In the next hour, we're going to open up the phone lines with your questions, calls, and comments. A Journey, Wheel in the Sky. Take us into the break here on Coast to Coast AM. We'll be right back.